The Mother, Chapter 5. If you want to be a true doer of divine works, your first aim must be to be totally free from all desire and self-regarding ego. All your life must be an offering and a sacrifice to the Supreme. Your only object in action shall be to serve, to receive, to fulfill, to become a manifesting instrument of the divine Shakti in her works. You must grow in the divine consciousness till there is no difference between your will and hers, no motive except her impulsion in you, no action that is not her conscious action in you and through you. Until you are capable of this complete dynamic identification, you have to regard yourself as a soul and body created for her service, one who does all for her sake. Even if the idea of the separate worker is strong in you, and you feel that it is you who do the act, yet it must be done for her. All stress of egoistic choice, all hankering after personal profit, all stipulation of self-regarding desire must be extirpated from the nature. There must be no demand for fruit and no seeking for reward. The only fruit for you is the pleasure of the Divine Mother and the fulfillment of her work. Your only reward, a constant progression in divine consciousness and calm and strength and bliss. The joy of service and the joy of inner growth through works is the sufficient recompense of the selfless worker. But a time will come when you will feel more and more that you are the instrument and not the worker. For first, by the force of your devotion, your contact with the Divine Mother will become so intimate that at all times you will have only to concentrate and to put everything into her hands to have her present guidance, her direct command or impulse, the sure indication of the thing to be done and the way to do it and the result. And afterwards, you will realize that the Divine Shakti not only inspires and guides, but initiates and carries out your works. All your movements are originated by her. All your powers are hers. Mind, life, and body are conscious and joyful instruments of her action, means for her play, molds for her manifestation in the physical universe. There can be no more happy condition than this union and dependence, for this step carries you back beyond the borderline from the life of stress and suffering in the ignorance into the truth of your spiritual being, into its deep peace and its intense ananda. While this transformation is being done, it is more than ever necessary to keep yourself free from all taint of the perversions of the ego. Let no demand or insistence creep in to stain the purity of the self-giving and the sacrifice. There must be no attachment to the work or the result, no laying down of conditions, no claim to possess the power that should possess you, no pride of the instrument, no vanity or arrogance. Nothing in the mind or in the vital or physical parts should be suffered to distort to its own use or seize for its own personal and separate satisfaction the greatness of the forces that are acting through you. Let your faith, your sincerity, your purity of aspiration be absolute and pervasive of all the planes and layers of the being. Then every disturbing element and distorting influence will progressively fall away from your nature. The last stage of this perfection will come when you are completely identified with the Divine Mother and feel yourself to be no longer another and separate being, instrument, servant, or worker, but truly a child and eternal portion of her consciousness and force. Always she will be in you, and you in her. It will be your constant, simple, and natural experience that all your thought and seeing and action, your very breathing and moving, come from her and are hers. You will know and see and feel that you are a person and power formed by her out of herself, put out from her for the play, and yet always safe in her, being of her being, consciousness of her consciousness, force of her force, ananda of her ananda. When this condition is entire, and her supramental energies can freely move you, then you will be perfect in divine works. Knowledge, will, action will become sure, simple, luminous, spontaneous, flawless, an outflow from the Supreme, a divine movement of the Eternal. Chapters 1 to 5, set up the closing chapter, but tell a story which is important to understand, the nature of the mission, to be receptive to the supramental light as it descends, removing all obstacles that would impair its planting itself in the soil of the earth. Then, making oneself a vessel in which aspiration, rejection, and surrender combine to effect the change of the nature. What is the ideal of the sadhak in adhesion to the Yoga Shakti? What is the nature, then, if one has the protection of the Divine to guide you and lead you along the way of the work that we have to do? We have to secure a basis for the Divine work upon this earth, and so we then see Sri Aurobindo bring the letter about how to deal with the money force into play, and now in this letter, how to dynamize our work, what should be not simply our attitude, but our actual experience. You remember the first was a mission statement given to the ashram in general, all those living around Sri Aurobindo, on the birthday of the mother in 1927, 21 February 1927. The second, written to Motilal. The third, the fourth, and the fifth, written to Poonam Chand Shah. Poonam Chand had gone from the ashram in Pondicherry to Gujarat, and he needed to be fortified, the third letter. He needed to know what he was going to do, what would be his attitude in asking people to contribute towards the maintenance and the furtherance of the Sri Aurobindo Ashram in Pondicherry, far, far away from Gujarat. And then this fifth letter, of course, is about how to do the work correctly. This letter was written on the 19th of August in 1927. Poonam Chand was a very well-known and popular bodybuilder, Karma Yogin, in Gujarat before he ever came to the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. And he was there first. Later, of course, Champaklal visited, returned to Gujarat. And then it was Poonam Chand and his wife, as I explained earlier, that brought Champaklal back. And then, after the Siddhi in 1926, sometime in 1927, Poonam Chand goes on this long journey back to Gujarat to see what he can do to gather force for the yoga. We've been putting this in a large context. This letter, of course, is written in the individual context. This is an ideal for the seeker. Sri Aurobindo had earlier exchanges with Poonam Chand. In 1921, he wrote a letter to him 7 years earlier in which he was suggesting to him that he establish in himself the separation of Purusha and Prakriti, that he establish a kind of tranquility of heart and mind based upon the recognition of the soul inside and the play of nature involving thoughts, feelings, and action through the body. So, the first thing, sit in the separated Purusha, become calm, watch the nature, observe Prakriti. And then, attending calmness in the heart of Prakriti. So, establishing first the peace and the witness poise inside, and then carrying that out into heart and mind, making it dynamic, involving it with the play of earth. The second thing he suggested to Poonam Chand was to offer all your actions, all that is done in your life as a sacrifice to the Lord, to the divine, as he put it in that letter. Very much what he's writing here in the fifth chapter, 7 years later, still working the same theme with Poonam Chand. Then, the third facet of this letter was encouraging Poonam Chand to gain the realization of the higher divine Shakti who is doing all the works. And again, very much in consonance with what this chapter is about in the mother. Living with the constant idea that is the Shakti who does the work. Feeling the divine Shakti descending from above the mind and moving the whole being. This he wrote 7 years earlier, and Poonam Chand is still working on this. But it's a letter that we can apply to ourselves. But clearly Poonam Chand was a personage of considerable importance in the early year or so of the ashram. He was the first librarian in the ashram. Premanand later took it up. He was entrusted with the goal of bringing funds back to vivify and support the ashram. He was not the only person who did that. I think it would be worth mentioning that the letters on the money force and the nature of how one does conscious work as a sacrifice to the divine was also seminal in other people, other aspirants. Not all of them lived in the ashram. There were a number of well-regarded disciples who were deeply engaged in sadhana. who were situated elsewhere. Among them, Dorai Swami, who lived in what we call Chennai now, then Madras. It was through his efforts that much of the main ashram building came into the possession of Mother and Sri Aurobindo. He helped pay for it through his work as a barrister, as an advocate, as a lawyer. So successful was he that he was offered a judgeship in the Madras High Court. The question about whether he should accept it or not was put to Sri Aurobindo, who wrote, "Your true way is not a leisurely meditative inaction, but a life of capacity and power. Your sadhana also lies much more through the heart and the dedication of the life force in you than through any withdrawal into passive meditation. Therefore, the proposed change would not be a real opportunity or help. On the other hand, it would cut your career and limit your means of action and dam up the tide of prosperity that we have set flowing for you." He wrote this letter to Dorai Swami on the 16th of September, 1927, about a month after he wrote Chapter 5. In other words, telling him that to retire into a judgeship means that he's going to sit in a study and he's going to read the case literature and he'll spend a couple of hours in the courtroom per day, but he won't be dynamic. As it was, Dorai Swami continued to work in the world, aiding and abetting eventually the liberation of India itself. He was an important political player and a builder of economic force throughout South India, centered in Tamil Nadu, and of course helped construct the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. What guided him through all these years was his deep connection to Sri Aurobindo. He had with him the volumes of the Arya, to which he could turn, because hardly any books had been published by then. His volumes of the Arya, by the way, sit in our library here. Mother said about Dorai Swami, as she gazed at him, she realized that he had been, in an earlier birth, Janaka, the great king sage, the ruler who first ruled himself, who lived in the consciousness of the Atman, of Brahman, who had the realization. And when his kingdom, when his palace had been set on fire somehow, and they came running to tell him, he didn't move. And they told him again, "Sire, where you live is a fire." He said, "If all of Mithila burned, it would not singe a hair of my real being." He was deeply ensconced in that. Janaka. Dorai Swami still carried that regal demeanor in his action in the life of the ashram. He was at ease with wealth. He was at ease with bare simplicity. He did not crow if money came his way. He did not lament if it passed away from him. And he had an active life. He had sons. One of his sons refused to undertake initiation, would not take upanayanam, unless Sri Aurobindo agreed to give him the mantra. You have to receive the initiating mantra from your teacher. He refused to do it unless Sri Aurobindo would give him the mantra. The mantra that Sri Aurobindo gave him is the mantra that we close our opening chants with. Om Tat Savitur Varam Rupam. That is what was given to that young man, Dorai Swami, his son. So it wasn't just a person or two who helped build the ashram. It was many people, all of them great souls. Mother, for a period in the early days of the ashram, would bother to go within to see, who is this? Where has he come from? Where in the past has he become connected to this work that he would feel called to birth now and step forward and aid in this? And so she said, this one is this, this one is that. We needn't go through all of it. I think she realized that it was having a lamentable effect upon them. They would rest in the glory of what they'd done in the past instead of remembering how much work they had to do now. I do remember that when N.P. Pundit joined the ashram in 1939, Mother made a comment to someone about who he had been in a previous birth. And Nolini said, don't tell him. Don't tell him. It will only make him proud. At least that's how he told me the story. I want to come back to Poonam Chand for a minute, if I may. I mentioned that he brought Champaklal to Sri Aurobindo in 1923, before there was an ashram. Champaklal did not again leave him. I need also to say that we lose track of Poonam Chand at some point. We don't know where he goes, even though he was seminal in the writing of this book, The Mother. After about 1930, he sort of evaporates. Mother makes a comment to Champaklal in 1930 that his, Poonam Chand's, influences were upon you for a long time, and I had to work and work and work to remove them, because by implication, they were distorting and ruining his relationship with her. I think I want to read to you a letter that Sri Aurobindo wrote to Champaklal. He says, write to Poonam Chand that now that Vital Das has seen the mother, he should communicate his experience or his difficulties direct to her. It is not desirable that in matters of the sadhana, Poonam Chand or anybody else should come in between, even as a channel of communication. The mother's force must go direct, undisturbed by other influences. This was written in December of 1928, just a few months after the book The Mother is published. So you can see that in letters 3, 4, 5, there is an insistence on the removal of the ego. Diminish the ego. Get out of the way. Let the light play in you. And it seems that Phunom Chan was having difficulty recognizing that his role was restricted to the perfection of his sadhana, that perhaps another role might be possible for him with respect to the larger ashram, but it was not in replacement of the mother's influence or guidance or action, that it was in submission to it, collaboration with it. We look at the first paragraph. If you want to be a true doer of divine works, be free from desire and self-regarding ego. All your life must be an offering and a sacrifice. This is, again, the Veda. The flame of the soul is Agni. The offering is your work. Your own being is your work. Your interactions with the world around represent you, the essence of your experience. So samarpana of the soul relieves the ego from its responsibility, pushes us to communion, and from communion to union. Then, of course, the distinction between the separate worker who gives service, who's so aware of the work that he or she is doing, that it is for someone. It must be for benefit, and benefit only of the one who receives, in this case, the divine Shakti. Without reference back to oneself, without a hankering for recognition, without demanding anything in return for it, a pure self-giving, like a child plucks a flower and brings it to its mother and says, "Look what I found." It gives like that. The spontaneity tells you something. You move from that idea to one of being an instrument when you feel that force directing your action, when you can feel that I actually am not the doer, but I perceive, I sense, through my body, through the vitality coursing through my limbs, through the emotions filling my breast, and the ideas that are conceived in my mind, that all of this is the play of that consciousness with a capital C. Then you can live in communion with that and become an instrument, no more a worker, because you are consciously in her hands. Now the collaboration is full. There's not the separation of self from object, of me from thee. Simply, this is doing that, and the doing is my being. That communion allows you to move more and more into the freedom of the psyche and escape being lost in the play of Prakriti. You discover within yourself the bliss from which you were born, the ananda from which you originally came, the peace from which you descended, and which you always innately possess, even as you work as a soul of fire, progressing as you liberate everything you touch from darkness and from ignorance. The psyche is a drop of that ananda, of that bliss. So you become increasingly more pure the ego begins to evaporate. Egoism goes, and ego, if it remains, can be diminished to the point where it no longer obstructs, where the soul is powerful enough to see the ego in its play and laugh and say, "Step aside, young fellow. Let me handle this." Let your faith, your sincerity, your purity of aspiration, this all speaks about oneness and sameness. When you have sincerity in you, it is something that includes increasingly all the being. It is not something static. It's progressive. Everything feels the charm of the right earnestness of being sincere. Not being callow, not being ironic, but being straightforward and sincere. Purity comes with sincerity. Aspiration heightens when one is pure. The things which limit and entangle us are naturally burned up as this psychic fire, which is what it is, burns more and more brightly. One becomes pure, pavitra. But this stage of being an instrument is also surrendered when one becomes fully identified with the Divine Mother. And you become a child sitting on her lap in the image of the Veda, an eternal portion, an amsha, of her consciousness and force. We're back to Chit Shakti. We spent years enjoying Sri Aurobindo's description of Chit Shakti through the pages of the Life Divine. Again, she's here. Always she will be in you and you in her. All your thought and seeing and action, your very breathing and moving, come from her and are hers. So let's see this. There's an awakened soul who begins to move in concert with the divine consciousness. The body is involved in this. It's active in the world. And the body begins to summate a hierarchical universe from Sat Chit Ananda, existence, consciousness, and bliss. Comes the constellated consciousness of the supramental that takes that infinite and throws it into harmonic order, expressing multifariously what it is in its essential oneness. And that establishes itself in more concrete and limiting terms, the nature of this cosmos, which nevertheless, while it hides from its own supreme self, contains it always within. And so we, as we awaken to this, summate this hierarchical universe in our body. We don't just awaken in the soul. We extend it powerfully into everything that we experience. So what you do, the work, the fifth chapter, what you do carves a path from what seems to be an ignorant universe back to the originating heights, back to the source, and in communion with that power, you draw down that light, that delight, into this very vessel. And it is shared, because it's not a solitary achievement. It is impossible to work in a solitary way. Every step that you take in solidarity with the universe around. So if you're successful in living from your soul, that gets shared. Yes, palpably. All the air will be charged with the felicity of the soul. If you bring the divine consciousness into your being and into the body, it will reverberate in all of nature. So, our experience is even cast into polity. Our changed consciousness, our personal transformation, becomes an incident in which the divine works on the larger society. Personal transformation leads to social transformation. Social transformation begins to summarize what is possible for the cosmos. So the individual linked with the all is the story of how we link the supreme to the earth. At the center of the Sri Aurobindo Ashram is the enlightened experience and power of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. And it moves out in waves. We see Poonam Chand go to Gujarat. He is successful. We see Dorai Swami going to Chennai. He is successful. The ashram begins to gather force at every level. All of it an expression of the gathering conscious power of the Divine Mother who is there, representing a demand that ignorance relent and that light be born upon this earth. So this is wonderful work and wonderful to read these letters while they have personal application. Sri Aurobindo saw they mean something for all of us in the ashram. It is a concerted collaboration. Concerted because we're in concert with each other. We're all playing the right instrument in our hands, part of a larger symphony, trying to conduct a piece of beautiful music. Bring it into play. Play of divine consciousness. So I've been threatening you with eventually speaking on matters of the tradition of the great goddess in India, and I think I may impose that upon you next week if you will be permissive. Next week, we will begin in some way dealing with the largest, the greatest chapter in the book, The Mother, the sixth chapter, where he deals with the four powers and personalities. So, we are, our dear Vasanti tells us, about to begin the Navaratri season in India. So we are marching from the victory of one goddess to the other for the next several days, culminating on the 10th with Vijaya Dashami. So keep a thought. An act of oblation here and there. Jai Ma, huh? So, from Savitri then. This is Book 1, Canto 3, The Yoga of the King, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. A skyward being nourishing its roots on sustenance from occult spiritual founts climbed through white rays to meet an unseen sun. His soul lived as eternity's delegate. His mind was like a fire assailing heaven, his will a hunter in the trails of light. An ocean impulse lifted every breath. Each action left the footprints of a god. Each moment was a beat of puissant wings. The little plot of our mortality, touched by this tenant from the heights, became a playground of the living infinite. This bodily appearance is not all. The form deceives. The person is a mask. hid deep in man, celestial powers can dwell. His fragile ship conveys through the sea of years an incognito of the imperishable, a spirit that is a flame of God abides, a fiery portion of the wonderful, artist of his own beauty and delight, immortal in our mortal poverty. This sculptor of the forms of the infinite, this screened, unrecognized inhabitant, initiate of his own veiled mysteries, hides in a small dumb seed his cosmic thought. In the mute strength of the occult idea, determining predestined shape and act, passenger from life to life, from scale to scale, changing his imaged self from form to form, he regards the icon growing by his gaze, and in the worm foresees the coming God. At last the traveler in the paths of time arrives on the frontiers of eternity. In the transient symbol of humanity draped, he feels his substance of undying self and loses his kinship to mortality. A beam of the eternal smites his heart. His thought stretches into infinitude. All in him turns to spirit vastnesses. His soul breaks out to join the oversoul. His life is oceaned by that super life. He has drunk from the breasts of the mother of the worlds. A topless supernature fills his frame. She adopts his spirit's everlasting ground as the security of her changing world and shapes the figure of her unborn mites. Immortally, she conceives herself in him, in the creature the unveiled creatrix works. Her face is seen through his face, her eyes through his eyes. Her being is his through a vast identity. Then is revealed in man the overt divine. A static oneness and dynamic power descend in him, the integral Godhead's seal. His soul and body take that splendid stamp. Namaste. Jai Ma.